lovely to hear such a pleasant hubbub of conversation. My name is Damian Pambini. I'm based here at the LSE, and I'm really delighted and excited that we're here to launch a new book, Digital Dominance, which we're going to start discussing even now. If you haven't seen any of our communications today, I'm afraid Sheila Mora has sent her apologies. Obviously, it's been a very exciting and feverish day in Westminster. But we're going to, I'm sure, fill that space and more with our discussion. We're going to be debating another issue of control and sovereignty related to the power of new kinds of information, intermediaries, platforms in our lives. And when Martin and I put this book together, we were thinking about it over a year ago. We thought we would do a problem definition book rather than a solutions book. And things have moved extremely fast in the debate. And we're already in a situation, I think, where policy has moved on and we're interested in trying to actually find solutions. So I'm hoping that discussion is going to start this evening with all of your ideas and the ideas of our panel. But the book is about asking some really big questions, which I just want to recap before I hand over to our speakers. First of all, we want to ask the big question of whether there is a problem, and in particular, whether there is a problem with market dominance that the market and competition policy combined cannot solve in relation to these new platforms and intermediaries. We also want to drill down. We conceive this very much as an interdisciplinary book. We don't think it's possible to even understand these policies without moving across different disciplines, which is why we have lawyers, economists, communication scholars, and a really wide range of disciplines, political scientists, in the book. So we want to ask questions about whether existing competition law actually can assess the problem of dominance and suggest solutions. We want to ask what the role of data is in cementing the dominance of platforms. And then we want to think about a wide range of policy desiderata. So the implications of platform dominance, the tech giants, which are named on the book cover, their implications for media pluralism, the freedom of expression, for agenda setting, public interest journalism, and particularly for elections. Ultimately, is there a problem of electoral legitimacy being undermined by dominant platforms? This is a big agenda for what is not a huge book, but we hope that we've made some kind of contribution to starting the debate on these issues. I should thank straight away the LSE Department of Media and Communications and the Truth, Trust and Technology Commission, which is chaired by Sonia Livingstone, who's a professor in the department and is going to be giving her comments on these issues today. They're supporting also a reception, which will follow our discussion. And I'm particularly pleased that my co-editor, Martin, who had the original idea that we should put this book together, and Paddy Barwise, one of our authors, are going to kick off the discussion as well. So I'm going to try and be a bit of a neutral chair, although when you read my chapter in the book, you'll see I have a little bit of skin in the game. But I will try and be a neutral chair and hand over immediately to Patrick Barwise, who is Emeritus Professor of Marketing at the London Business School. Thanks very much. Well, the key word there is nine. Okay, you don't have to remember nine. The key word is, the implication is many. Right. There are lots of reasons. It's not just one or two reasons. And we're saying winner-take-all. Economists talk about winner-take-all markets, meaning markets with very high market concentration, especially if there are fundamental reasons for that. Now, in the 1960s, IBM dominated the market for mainframes. It still does. But mainframes were then overshadowed by PCs, and then more recently by the cloud. In the 1980s, Microsoft and Intel respectively dominated the markets for PC software and hardware. They still do. But those markets in turn have been largely overshadowed by markets which are based on different application areas sitting on top of the World Wide Web. The World Wide Web, which launched in 1990, and those include search, dominated by Google, e-commerce, dominated by Amazon, social networking, dominated by Facebook, and those companies are still dominating those markets. And now we have the mobile internet, and Apple is the most profitable and valuable company on the planet, and so on. So there seems to be a bit of a pattern here. It's described as tech winners can be eclipsed but not displaced. In other words, these tech markets, they start highly contested. Once someone becomes the market leader, it appears to be virtually impossible to knock them off their leadership of that market, which is their core market. Instead, what can happen is another adjacent market arises using newer technology, which then becomes more important and bigger. And if they aren't dominating that new market, then they get overshadowed. So they can be eclipsed, but not displaced. So what are the reasons? What are the factors behind that? Well, first of all, there are some what I'd call hard reasons, which come out of economics and technology. And these are, in a sense, relatively obvious and should be fairly familiar, okay? But they're still really important. The first is traditional economies of scale, scope, and learning. The second is there are two kinds of network effect. You will have heard a lot of talk about network effects. There are within network effects, which is what you get with all communication markets like telephony and so on, that the value to each user increases as there are more other users to communicate with. What we now have in addition, even more important, is these between market indirect network effects, which aka multi-sided markets in the economics jargon. And that is, for instance, if I set up a platform, which is a restaurant booking platform, the more restaurants there are on my platform, the higher the value to each potential diner. And the more diners use the platform, the more valuable the platform is to the restaurants, and the more I can charge the restaurants. So those are really important, and pretty well all of these tech businesses are, to a greater or lesser extent, platform businesses. And then, of course, we've got big data. And, you know, the key word in big data is big, that quantity drives quality, and the gods of big data are very much on the side of the big battalions. So these effects multiply each other. But they're not the only factors, because there are also various behavioral effects, and they are both on the demand side and on the supply side. And on the demand side, there are two effects which can't be completely separated from each other. There are sort of technical switching costs and behavioral switching costs. So the very fact that Google is now a verb is a behavioral switching cost. But you just reach for Google, you don't actively think, which search engine will I use? It just becomes a habit. And then there are various other forms of lock-in to do with, you know, data you've built up, walled gardens in which you can't, you know, buy an app on one system and then use it on another system and so on. But then, in addition, brands are hugely important in these markets,
And that is not what a lot of the digerati expected. If you look back at what they were saying in the 1990s, okay, as well as saying that this was sort of the end of the corporate world, and it was all democratizing and all of those flat earth type statements, in addition, they said, why would people still need brands? Because, you know, they use intelligent agents to do their shopping for them, and the intelligent agent will simply buy the best product, you know, that's on offer this week and whatever. Now, two of the founders were smart enough to realize that wasn't true. One of them, who was very intuitive, was Steve Jobs. And there's a very strong, I mean, Apple is just a wonderful brand. But the other, who's much more analytical, is Jeff Bezos, who was a very successful 30-year-old Wall Street guy. And Bezos, before they started, said, brands will be more important in the online world than in the offline world. And so it has proved. So most of the most valuable brands in the world are tech brands, primarily American ones, and now a few like Alibaba. So the death of brands did not happen. On the supply side, then these companies are also employer brands. They have employee brand equity as well as consumer brand equity. And they're a magnet for the best commercial and technical talent. Less obviously, perhaps, they have extreme geographical clustering. Now, Dr. Liam Fox has said we are potentially at the beginning of a post-geography trading world. Well, I don't think so. Right? So the three of these five companies are in Silicon Valley. The other two are 2 hours plane ride away to the north in Seattle. But also a lot of the other tech companies are also in Silicon Valley and so on. So we now have, I think, a better understanding than we used to have about, you know, why is it that innovation is clustered? Why is Hollywood still in Hollywood? Why is the City of London still in the City of London and so on? And, you know, there are multiple reasons I won't bore you with, but we did not see the death of distance. The expression, the death of distance, that was the title of a book by Francis Cairncross, who was a very, very bright journalist at The Economist, and it came out in 1997, and it turned out to be largely wrong. Okay? The internet has not banished distance. Geography still matters. The biggest project in the world is the Chinese Belt and Road Initiative, which is aimed at reducing the effect of geography in Eurasia and Africa. Finally, there's a whole lot of behavioral and cultural issues around these powerful founders who have controlling voting shares still, very aggressive political lobbying, they're very litigious companies, aggressive tax avoidance and so on. So Facebook is now obviously trying to become more respectable, but its former motto was move fast and break things. And you know, that in reality is the culture. So what are the implications? Once they become dominant, well-managed big tech firms are in general, and so far pretty much without exception, unlikely to lose their market dominance, certainly in the foreseeable future. Therefore, I would argue traditional competition policy, especially US antitrust policy, which is now sort of post the involvement of Chicago School economists, only based on demonstrable consumer harm. That doesn't work in the context of Google, where you get very high quality services for free, or Facebook, or any of the, particularly the advertising funded tech companies. Therefore, yes, Damien, we do have a problem.
Rapidly go through some opening statements. But if anyone has a pressing factual clarification or something they need to in brief, they can do so now.
David stole my pad. So
and your pencil.
So, shall I kick off?
Please do.
There's a vicar in front of me. So, Damien introduced me as the chair of our Truth, Trust and Technology Commission, which I'm very pleased to be. And for those who don't know about it, this is a commission we're running at the LSE this year, to try to, as it were, identify what is exactly the problem that everyone is talking about and that this book is clearly addressing and offering an analysis of. In other words, how do we think about the structural causes of misinformation? What kinds of solutions do we want to come up with? And what would very kind of multidisciplinary and multi-stakeholder debate help us to understand? So the Commission is working with four strands: journalism credibility, platform responsibility, political communications, media literacy, and citizenship. And we're in the midst of a process of hearing evidence, holding debates, and indeed consulting the public. So I'm going to kind of weave a few thoughts about the challenge facing the Commission into my remarks, which kind of take off from the book that we're here to celebrate today. Now, I'll just make a reference back to a comment that a discussion I had with Robin Mansell a few months ago when we were talking about Dallas Smythe. I hope she doesn't mind my saying this. Renowned instigator, really, of the theory of political economy of communication, which in many ways this book illustrates. And I was worrying about this as an audience researcher, wondering, as it were, where are the people within a political economy of communication? And Robin brilliantly told me that this is what Dallas Smythe has said is a key question for, you know, where are the people? So as an audience researcher, as well as the Commission chair, I've been thinking, I kind of read the book to see where are the people. What is being implied about people in the way in which the analysis is proceeding, not only here, but really much more widely in our society. So I'm very attuned to use of words like markets, users, newspaper readers, television viewers, consumers, now data subjects. And we have a kind of a host of words for how we think about how people are implicated within the processes that we, the process of, if you like, digital dominance, and a sense that many things are going wrong. And we could add content creators, families, voters, workers. I mean, they all appear. And of course, the words are always, as it were, appropriate to their context. But each implies a kind of particular set of capacities on the part of the people and their relation to the society, a particular set of competences and contexts within which their actions and the actions of business upon them really matters. So I think the way in which Damien and Martin kind of try to bring us to this, and really saw this most clearly in their last chapter, which brings together the argument, is to call for a theory of harm. And I think if we think about a theory of harm in relation to these different ways of thinking of the public or the people or the market, whatever, we come up with different emphases about what a theory of harm should offer. And the last chapter suggests three as really key. One is harm to the fundamental rights of human beings. One is harm to the what's described as the social goods, as in the legitimacy of democracy, most often, most obviously. And the third is economic benefits and detriment to a narrowly defined consumer. And the chapter is actually called Dominance, the Citizen Interest and the Consumer Interest, which brought me back to a book that I wrote with Peter Lunt a few years ago, in which we trace the origins of Ofcom and its struggle to do what was required by the Communications Act of 2003, which was to promote the interests of citizens as well as consumers. So what was interesting looking back a few years is how the citizen debate then was already framed as a losing debate, almost not allowed into the Act, apart from a struggle led, in fact, by Lord Putnam. And the consumer interest seemed to be the obvious way in which a regulator should work, should address its market, and should construct people as consumers. So this book, in a way, provoked me to wind back the last 15 years and say, okay, suppose we hadn't at that point seen the consumer interest as the obvious one to prioritise, and had we then articulated the citizen interest, perhaps we wouldn't be quite in the position that this book analyses and that Paddy so eloquently just outlined. So the Commission is addressing, as it were, the problem for citizens, the problem of misinformation, the problem of media literacy, the problem of election hacking, the problem for democracy, as well as, of course, the problem of markets. And so our theory of harm is, in a sense, kind of contingent on the particular history and the particular moment in which we find ourselves. So the hard question, perhaps, is, as it were, what's the theory of benefit by which we can counter the theory of harm? We can kind of, you know, put together a stellar job of analysing what's going wrong. So what do we want? What do we think would be right? What would be the right answer? And this, I think, is what the hardest question that's being faced by the Truth, Trust and Technology Commission, apart from, curiously, not only the question of what do we want, but also the question of what exactly do we think is wrong. Perhaps this book has the answer, but it's interesting how, as you look at technology and technological markets, you start kind of moving away to a sense that actually the problems are also in the society, there are problems of history, there are bigger problems of political economy, in which, in a sense, the platforms are the symptom rather than the cause. So reading this book, Digital Dominance, also gave me pause for thought in our analysis of problems within the Commission. But yes, so what do we want? What would be the theory of benefit? How much longer have I got, Daniel?
You've done 2 minutes.
2 minutes, good. Okay. Two possibilities to conjure with in thinking about what would be the benefit. Okay, so the benefit for citizens, and I will call people citizens though, because they're addressed in many ways already rather well as consumers, the citizen interest would lie in a conception of media literacy, which is not about internet safety and not about minimal functionality of managing the technological environment, but about having the knowledge to function as a citizen in a healthy democracy. And that now includes having the knowledge to understand how to critically appraise the technological environment through which democratic processes are mediated, and indeed to have the knowledge and capacity to be able to act effectively within that environment, not merely as recipients and beneficiaries of many policies, but as agents and actors within them. But as I said in our media literacy workshop, whenever it was, a couple of weeks ago, you cannot teach or educate, you cannot teach people what's unteachable. And you cannot reach people who are unreachable. And our problem is that we're trying to teach people almost impossible tasks of understanding, because in fact no one can really tell you how the platform, but you can read a 200-page book and find out a lot more than you knew before. And you cannot really reach people past the age of 18 without any kind of effectiveness, except, ironically, through the very platforms which we are concerned about. The media and the social media are the only means we have of reaching post-18s with any kind of effectiveness. The second kind of question, which one might ask, so that turns us to the question of, you know, how much can the platforms themselves provide the solutions? And there's a lot of call at the moment on the platforms to provide everything from media literacy to authentication of journalist integrity to self-regulation of their own market excesses, etc. No one, I think, is happy with the idea that they should be their own kind of judge and jury. So another question that we might consider in the Commission is, could there be an institution of oversight? Could there be an institution, an independent public institution, that, as it were, has oversight of the market and the platforms as they operate within it? So let's think, and do we want yet another regulator or another independent body in this space? So that again takes me back to the decision made now 20 years ago that yes, we should have Ofcom. Perhaps, I think that was quite a good idea. despite its struggles, despite its persistent preferring of the citizen, of the consumer interest over the citizen interest. And again, in our book on media regulation, Peter Knight and I try to identify some of the ways in which that, as a regulator, has been an effective regulator, and the principles by which it tried to regulate in the public interest. And then through a series of case studies, we try to identify some of the ways in which things have gone wrong, and the, as it were, the independence and the kind of citizen interest priority within Ofcom lost out to all kinds of political struggles, which a number of people here, many people here, have been following very closely. Now we're doing the same with the Information Commissioner Office, interestingly. We're kind of souping it up and giving it more powers and giving it more money and asking it again to do exactly that kind of regulatory, public interested oversight of these extraordinarily powerful platforms. So I've learned to call GAFA, I have to Google GAFA yesterday, but that's just my ignorance, and now I'm keeping up. So I will stop with those really questions. Do we agree with this analysis of the problem? What other analysis of the problem might be? How is the theory of harm shaped by particular contexts at the time? And what is our account of benefit? What are we working towards?
Thank you very much. Okay, Martin, we've got a lot of ideas on the table, and you're going to make sense of them all.
If I can read my scribbles. Thank you very much, and thank you all for coming. I can see some familiar faces here, and a very, very informed audience. I'm extremely conscious of that. I wanted to just come back to it was over 2 years ago when Damien and I decided to do this book back in 2016, the year 2016, yes. And it was over a set lunch, a very nice set lunch in Oxford, where we were enjoying it so much I got a parking ticket afterwards. But I remember because when we were talking about it and discussing it, and we got into many of the issues, we were part of a small but growing brigade of people who were really talking about digital dominance. And it sounds peculiar now because we've moved so fast and so far the other way. I don't want to mention the T words and the B words, but there are very clear political reasons why that is. But it's sort of remarkable how far we've gone. Back then, I remember the key concerns when it came to the tech giants were really very specific. I mean, there was lots of discussion around encryption and the problem of terrorism and encryption. There were specific problems around bullying and harassment on the sites. But this idea of digital dominance and the problem of the scale and reach and dominance of these companies was at that point still quite a minor pursuit. Now, it's quite rare, I think, that a week goes by that we don't hear about some problem of dominance. Admittedly, that's been dominated for many months now by Facebook, but we do also hear about issues regarding Google. Amazon is, of course, growing and growing on the horizon. And now we find out we'll be streaming live football rights. I'm sure that will gain a lot more interest for Amazon. And we've swung, I think, in many ways, too far the other way. And I'll explain what I mean by that. In some ways, clearly it's welcome. Clearly it's welcome that we are focusing on these questions. It's provoked a lot of very, I think, important debates. We don't have politicians going wide-eyed to the Googleplex anymore to be seen to be associating themselves with the future, or at least I haven't seen any recently. But I, despite being very anxious about digital dominance, very anxious, I find myself sort of urging caution, certainly caution in the short term, if not boldness in the long term. And the reason for that is because I think what seems to have happened is that democratic governments have sort of become slightly panicked and slightly rabbit in the headlights when it comes to these companies, and are desperate, it seems, to legislate, to pass laws to tame them, to control them. And to deal with very specific problems in a slightly knee-jerk way as they arise. And I think there's you don't need to go much further than one specific example to see this writ large, which is about the way in which governments around the world have reacted to this the problem, and I apologize in advance for the use of the term, but you have to use the term, the problem of fake news. So around the world, we have governments who are either legislating or considering legislating about the proliferation of fake news online, from France to the Philippines, from Germany to Malaysia. I mean, only last week, we had Emmanuel Macron wanting to pass a law which will empower judges to decide within 48 hours whether or not news should be censored. Now, put it to one side for a second, the difficulty, particularly in a very intense pre-election period, of trying to distinguish what is true and what is false when it comes to political information. There's huge practical questions around how on earth a judge within 48 hours is going to be able to assess things like whether Macron has an offshore bank account somewhere in the Bahamas or in the Caribbean. And that's in many ways one of the more reserved laws that's being considered or going through. I mean, I encourage you to go and look at what Malaysia is doing in terms of not just the laws around fake news, but around the way in which they are promoting sort of slightly Orwellian campaign to prosecute people who create fake news, but who share it, who like it, who share it online. Now, I think not all, but I think many of these government initiatives are generally well-intentioned. I don't think that most of these governments think that they are doing a particularly bad thing, but the effect, in many cases, I think, will be the empowerment of what Mark Zuckerberg, of all people to quote, called arbiters of truth. So we start to create a whole cadre, whether it's the institutions themselves, the tech giants, whether it's new institutions that are created, whether it's judges. In the case of Italy in the pre-election period, they encourage people to go to the police to respond and to decide what was fake and what was not fake. Now, this is not to say that governments should not respond. I think, on the contrary, my own view is that actually we're going through this huge period of transition, and they're in the response in the long term will have to be much, much bolder. But it is to say that the responses need to be much better informed and much more understanding of the environment in which they are made than they are currently. And Damien mentioned at the beginning, I mean, the purpose behind this book at the beginning was to examine the problem from many, many different angles, economic, social, political, not to start to come to responses. And even though the pendulum has swung so swiftly to the other side, I'm extremely glad that we did that because, and of course I would say this, wouldn't I, because I'm biased, but I genuinely think that, you know, policymakers could do a lot worse than reading this book and reading other books like it before they start rushing down the road to legislate. Because I think the questions, and I certainly learned this from reading many of the chapters in the book, the questions that the tech giants raise are really genuinely complex. These are not simple binary questions. There is not an easy political answer to lots of these questions. I'll just give some examples, because this is how, in a way, the purpose of the book was to get leaders in the field to take particular questions and then examine them, not necessarily come to solutions, but to show why they're difficult or why we need to rethink our current tools and our current legislation before we deal with them. So Natalie Helberger, in her chapter, she addresses this whole issue about media diversity and plurality, which is, of course, one of the central issues of media policy. And she argues that actually we have to completely rethink. In the old world, if you like, legacy media, media diversity and plurality was very much around how many outlets are there out there and what are they providing. It doesn't make sense to apply that question to a world in which you can go via a platform and ostensibly get access to almost infinite information from around the world. It has to be a different type of question. And she looks at it much more from the relationship between the platforms, the media organizations, and the users. But as I say, she argues that we have to completely redefine our understanding of what we mean by media diversity and plurality. There are, I think, at least three chapters looking at antitrust and competition law, all from different angles, but many of them come to a similar point, which is to say that at the moment as it stands, call it antitrust in the US or competition law here, simply isn't really fit to deal with these companies as they exist. In particular, this question around how one justified intervention. At the moment, especially in the US, much more than Europe, or Europe is similar, it's very much based around the idea of consumer harm. And both Diane Coyle in the book and Lena Khan talk about why that is such a inadequate definition, an inadequate metric when you're trying to decide whether or not to intervene in these particular companies. And one of the main reasons why competition regulators have not intervened over the last few years. And another aspect is around data and the use of personal data, the way in which these companies have gathered personal data and they're able to use it in such a way that they can move into different markets, essentially in what might be considered an anti-competitive way because they are significantly advantaged by the fact they have all this personal data, but where competition regulators find it very, very difficult to justify intervention on that basis. In Ben Wagner's chapter, and it's been mentioned already, but we are hearing, again, on a very regular basis, democratic governments telling these tech giants to take responsibility, for the problems that they've created. Of course, if they do take responsibility, then in many ways that will empower them significantly more. And those platforms themselves, and they know it themselves, that's why they push back, I think, very hard. Those platforms don't want to be in a position, we don't think they want to be in a position, where they are deciding on a very regular, very immediate basis what is true and what is not true. That's what they have to do now in Germany as a result of the NetzDG law. Essentially, the social media platforms have to make a decision, often generally within 48 hours, but sometimes within a week, as to whether or not something breaks one of 22 different laws as regards to hate speech and other illegal forms of speech. And that's very difficult for a court to do, let alone for an internal court within Facebook. So I won't go through, I mean, the point I suppose I'm making is that throughout what we try to do throughout the book and what I still try and do is try to better understand what the problems are that these tech giants have created, or not necessarily created, but that we're seeing manifested partly as a consequence of the growing dominance of these tech giants. And therefore, by better understanding them, much better understand how we start to respond. And in particular, the thing that struck me throughout is that the kind of specific knee-jerk responses, whether it's to fake news, whether it's to bullying, whether it's harassment, are completely ignore the kind of scale and reach and span of these companies such that they don't recognize the amount of ripple effects and the butterfly effects that almost any interventions will have with these companies. These companies now span such huge populations and such phenomenal, are so integrated into our lives. We rely on them so heavily now that by changing one thing in one place, you have no idea how that will follow through and knock right the way down the line and have effects literally around the world in many, many other countries. Now, clearly, as Damien says, this book does not answer all the questions. I would certainly hope that the policymakers themselves would investigate. I think one of the things we've been learning over the last few months is with the Culture Media Sports Select Committee, once you start pulling at a string, you never know where it'll go. The Select Committee that began on fake news is now looking more and more closely into the use of data by Facebook and elsewhere. But until I think they better understand, what the problems are, until they better understand how big the transition is that we're going through, I would urge all policymakers, I don't know if they're in this room, to wait and to be cautious rather than to rush in and legislate.
Urgency is waiting much, and are there things that maybe need to be done soon?
Dave and I slightly disagree on this one. So.
I think I have loads of questions, but I'm going to hold them back and get straight out there to you, the audience, if you have comments and questions at this point. One at the back here.
Governments are looking for a solution. Have you seen introduction? instruction of focusing on media literacy, like Sonia was saying, like focusing on teaching people how to distinguish fake news from the real news as opposed to censorship. And the other one being, is there a discussion about incentivizing these companies to self-regulate, as opposed to having an independent body that judges if you can put out your fake news within 48 hours? Is it a matter of Facebook, Google, whoever, if you're putting out information that is found to be fake, that there's some kind of punishment or penalty for that? Cause them to be incentivized to self-regulate.
Could I ask that we have a rule of just self-identification? When you ask a question, if you're representing any particular organization or...
I'm a student at LSE.
Okay.
Yeah.
Me? Yeah. Hi, I'm Sushani Sujan. I'm a former student of LSE, so it's great to be back here. Currently at Regent's University London. So I have kind of two questions, and I guess you, Patty, you mentioned Baidu and Alibaba, so I'm wondering how it is that they fit into, you know, this GAFA, this meta economy, I suppose. The other question is really about...
Can you say that again, more slowly?
How Baidu and Alibaba fit in with this sort of, you know, Western dominance here.
Yes.
And the other part of the question is, what exactly is dominance here? Because all of these GAFA or GAFA, if you include Microsoft and Baidu and Alibaba, although that's less catchy, is about platformization and, you know, the ways in which these companies are so massive and have across so many different sectors, you know, so that convergence and that platformization, how does that, what does that mean in terms of dominance, whether that's legacy media or digital media?
This is my co-author, Leo Watkins, I should say.
I'm a master student at Queen Mary. So, to respond to what Martin said about this kind of explosion of concerns since 2016, I think one of the crucial things that's changed, or not so much changed, has been kind of activated, is the traditional media's perceptions of where its interests lie in this area. Because although we're talking about the big platforms, much of our perception of what problems these platforms are throwing up is being brought to us by the traditional media, which has a distinct set of commercial and often political interests which are driving its inflation of concern. So, for example, fake news. There is very little evidence, actually, that fake news had a decisive role in the US elections. A very good paper about this that came out quite recently, I can't remember the authors, but which basically concluded that on average, US electors saw maybe one fake news article, maybe two, over the course of the election period. The obvious culprit, if you like, in Brexit was the right-wing press in this country, and in America it was Fox News, which is far more powerful than fake news. So, yet you'll find that the owners of these news organisations are fairly concerned about fake news. Why? Well, in this country, in order to redirect attention away from regulating the press, quite obviously. So there is, I think, the reason that the politicians have kind of developed this concern so suddenly is because they read the media too. They're very sensitive to the lobbying of news organisations, and those organisations have capitalised over the last year or two on creating a discourse about the problem with our democracy is the digital giants. Now, digital giants have contributed.
This is great.
Sorry, the point is the digital giants have contributed to the problem insofar as they have made things worse for the traditional media and undermined the economics of news in a system where news is provided privately. So the real policy intervention, and should not be to regulate the digital giants, it should be to find ways of funding news. That is actually the core damage that the platforms have caused.
Just to push back, maybe push it over to Paddy. I'm having difficulty reconciling two claims here. One is that this is something, a put-up job by the media, and the other is that there is a problem of dominance that the market will not resolve. Maybe we can come back to that in discussion.
We've got three questions now, three sets of questions.
Yeah. You're probably reaching capacity, are you? Should we have a round?
This
is great that there are loads of questions. Hold on to them. Let's be selective about the ones you have burning and good answers to. You can say you saw your first.
Well, I'll take the first point first about media literacy and government policy. The answer is no, not as far as I can tell. promoting media literacy was a duty of Ofcom laid down in the Communications Act 2003, which they dropped in 2010, and there's been no call to bring it back until this year, when fake news hit and we suddenly realised we should have been doing it all along. It makes a very sporadic appearance in the school curriculum. Media studies, as many of us know, is the lowest of the low in terms of the status, not recognised as a subject even for entrance in this university, sadly. So I think there's a problem. And as I said, for adults, ways to reach them, the only way that I can see is through the media or through a government information campaign, which we might worry about too. So what worries me is that media literacy is never anyone's first solution, but it's very often their last solution when they've said, oh dear, it's very difficult to deal with journalists and fund the news, regulate the platforms, whatever. At that point, it's okay, we'll have to educate the public. And it's the last backstop solution to a very peculiar miscellany of problems that are left hanging when other policies have failed, as it were. That's no way to build an education policy. And the Department of Education, in any way, is never, in my experience, correct me if I'm wrong, part of this conversation.
I'm assuming you're referring
just
to the UK.
Yeah, here.
Paddy, and then Martin. Well, I think that what we've said all along is that, if you like, the focus here is on identifying the problems, and primarily citizen problems. This book is not comprehensive. I think there are two citizen problems it does not address. One of them is these big tech companies not paying tax. Who's going to pay for the hospitals if most property companies are not paying any tax? And the second is inequality. There's some evidence that they contribute to inequality. And when you ask the question about media literacy, you know, rightly, we should also remember that there are at least 8 million adults in this country who, for practical purposes, are not online. And they are the heaviest users of public services. And we're spending a lot of money on online public services, but we're spending essentially no money on getting online the people who are the heaviest users of public services. The question about regulation, my hunch is that we will end up in a rather sort of messy combination, which is sort of co-regulation. In other words, they sort of mark their own homework, but then it's second graded in some sense by Ofcom. And this is not an ideal solution, but my hunch is that's sort of where we'll end up. BAT, you know, Baidu, Alibaba, Tencent. In the chapter, we look at, okay, so who might the competition be? And there are three types of competitor who might make a difference. The first is the other gaffer companies. Okay, so they are actually at the margin competing against each other. Because of this model where their first priority is to defend their core market, but because these are going to take all markets, that doesn't, if you like, use up all their capacity. Then they are starting to invest in potential growth markets which are beyond their core. So, for instance, several of them are now investing very heavily in the cloud. Amazon's the biggest cloud company. Amazon's the biggest supplier of cloud services to startups, which incidentally gives it an inside view on which are the successful startups, which might threaten its business or which might be good investment opportunities. So there's quite a lot sort of going on there. The second source of competition is other, almost certainly US companies. And then, of course, the third is the big Chinese companies, which are very big. They have been operating largely within Greater China. They are starting to go elsewhere, and because they're Chinese, their strategies are somewhat less focused than Western companies tend to be, but there's a degree of convergence which is happening now, because the big US companies are now more diversified than they used to be, because they're in their core businesses and they're now in, you know, self-driving cars and you know, other businesses, especially Alphabet. And at the same time, the Chinese companies are now starting to operate outside China. So I think that's where you will sort of start to see the clash. Obviously, the Chinese companies are also operating in a very, very different political environment, where big data is very good for them because there are a lot of Chinese, and also because the Chinese government has a rather different view of privacy. On Leo's question, yes, of course it's true that there's a degree of theatre about, you know, the national newspapers making a lot of fuss about fake news. If you read the later chapters in the book, I think you may think there is a bigger problem than was suggested by the way you asked the question. Yeah, there are some really quite worrying empirical, and the effect sizes are bigger than I expected of some of these influences. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
I'll just pick up a couple. I mean, on the incentives question, I think you're right, absolutely right to focus on incentives, but I'd step back a bit before you get into regulation, because I think actually one of the biggest problems at the moment is that the structural incentives online are warped in such a way that they encourage things like the invention of views and sensational, very, very clever, attention grabbing. And I spent about, well, far too long, about 2 months recently, trying to really understand what the industry calls ad tech, so digital advertising. It is unbelievably complicated. So complicated that it's essentially opaque simply by being complex rather than necessary, because it is opaque. But as a consequence, it means that we have this almost anarchic system, which is run virtually entirely by the market in sort of very Milton Friedman-esque, Hayekian kind of like purist way, which means that actually you have virtually no filters. I mean, apart from very, very vague community guidelines when it comes to, particularly when it comes to sort of buying advertising, placing advertising. It's no surprise that we have issues with Russian interference and whatever else, because the way that ad tech works. A question about, take a very different angle, the question about the Chinese companies. I think what Chinese companies are really, really interested in what could happen if governments put either too much pressure on these companies or insist too much on collaboration. So Chinese companies work in lots of areas, very close collaboration with the Chinese government. And so it does become something more Huxley meets Orwell. I mean, you know, you do have a situation where in some of the companies, there's actually a police station on site. So if they're you know, in the process of, you know, people engaging via QQ or whatever the service is, they come across something, they can literally sort of walk out there down the corridor to the little police station and pass on the information. So, you know, there is an incredible degree of convergence. And that's, I think, part of the problem is if huge amounts of pressure is put on these companies both to be responsible and to work with governments, then, you know, we do have a kind of a real, you know, forget surveillance capitalism, we have surveillance government as well. Which comes to the question, I mean, one of the things I think is really interesting at the moment about the relation between traditional media and these platforms is this, Emily Bell has a chapter in the book where she talks about the dependent press, and her argument is that actually what we're going to see is the press becoming more and more dependent upon these platforms, to the point where, you know, they are virtually unable to function without these platforms. And so I'm not sure, I don't know, whether at the moment it's sort of they're kicking out against the platforms because they don't want that to happen, and they're very anxious about that happening, but it'll happen inevitably. Or whether it is just as you say, they're eating our advertising lunch and we're angry about it and we're going to make a big fuss and noise about it.
Three people on this side waiting to come in. Four are rising. Can I ask you to just say who you are, where you're from? Not everybody will know. Robin, William, Jonathan, I know.
I'm Robin.
Yes.
Problem, but what do you imagine will be the result over the next 5 to 10 years of doing nothing other than what is happening at the moment? And I ask that question because it seems to me that we keep looking for a singular solution. Should it be a new institution? Should we regulate? And it seems to me that if we ask the question, what do you imagine in the next 5 years even, will be the consequence for those people that Sonia was mentioning? do the panelists actually imagine will happen if we just kind of carry on saying we can't do anything because we don't have enough evidence? Thank you.
I'm William Perrin, trustee of Carnegie UK Trust, and a very long time ago when I was a lad, I was the civil servant who brutally project managed the communication of white paper into existence that created Ofcom. And Sonia, where media literacy came from then was Tessa Jowell and Chris Smith. So at that point, I felt, as a civil servant who was running the project, essentially, in the absence of senior management who butted off and let me get on with it, was that it was a proxy for us being told not to regulate the press. Because at that time, only 10% of the population ever used the internet, and only 3% of the population had it at home. So back in 2000, the internet was not our big dominant consideration when we set the basic principles out of how Ofcom was to work. And then when Ofcom took that on, I just got the sense that, again, they didn't quite get it because they weren't allowed to regulate the press, and that's what it was a proxy for, was understanding media dominance. And then as the internet came to greater prominence, they just had to develop capabilities. It was a great shame when they came back to that strand of work. But on to sort of more current affairs, this issue about do we regulate or not? Well, right now, and Martin, you know, I take, because you and I discussed this 3 or 4 years ago, and we were sitting there feeling rather frightened that people might be listening to us as we discussed how dominant they were. I remember some of the conversations. Well, you know, the Law Commission has been tasked to review a whole bunch of laws on trolling, as they call it, but all the stirring up offences and hate offences because the government said they're not working. The Law Commission's had its timetable abbreviated, so it's been told to come back in November this year with a report. But Carnegie UK, and the Law Commission's been behind very profound changes, sweeping changes to the law in the past, as we all know. So that's the game to watch right now, that's what the Law Commission's doing, and they haven't even started their consultation. Carnegie UK Trust, working with Professor Lorne Woods from Essex, she and I put together a proposal that maybe we could use a traditional duty of law to reduce harm on the largest social media platforms. That's all worked up. We've sort of worked the proposal up. It's there on the Carnegie UK Trust website, and it's the first draft of our thinking. To our astonishment, within 2 weeks of finishing that, the government came out and said, right, we're going to legislate, and we've got 6 months to come up with a white paper on how we're going to do it. Now, when I did the white paper 15 years ago, it took us 9 months. And I remember while we were doing that, Peter Bazalgette said that it was as likely to be produced on time as Jerry Springer being admitted to the Order of Merit. And we pinned that on the wall to keep the team going. Now, 6 months is a very short time. You know, you just go and speak to the civil servants, and they're working hard on it. You know, they're very earnest in their endeavour to get some rules. But that is the timetable that's been set by politicians to do this work. And we're in very turbulent political times. We don't know what the opposition wants to do. We don't know if the civil servants will be allowed to focus on this enough, given all the Brexit nonsense that's going on. That is the timetable the government is set, and it does intend to do something. So all of us in the room, it's very good to see some faces I've not seen for a very long time here. We need to put our shoulders to that wheel and help them get it right.
Thank you very much. Jonathan Hayward from Impress. I'm slightly building on Will's point about law and regulation. It doesn't stop. I sort of take Martin's point. It's about the only thing I've probably ever slightly disagreed with you on in several years, but I take the point that we shouldn't rush into things and we should be cautious in the short term, but the long term. But on the other hand, the specialness of the platforms is not that they do something entirely new, but that they do lots and lots of things that have been done for a very long time in new ways. Now that may aggregate into something entirely new, but on the other hand, the laws around defamation, privacy, data protection, elections, advertising, press regulation, broadcast regulation, gambling law, there are all sorts of bits of law which do bear, or perhaps don't clearly enough bear, but should bear on their activities. So I don't think it's really an option to say, let's take a deep breath and really spend a few years thinking it through, because whether it's with government pressure or not, there will be law, it will be judgment law if it's not statute law. And by the same token, I think to compare what happens in Malaysia and Germany and France and elsewhere in the same breath is a bit of a red herring. It's another thing we often see from the press when they talk about the perils of press regulation. I think we need to have a bit of a matrix here to look at some potential laws and regulations, and rather as we do with free speech laws, the laws that bear on free speech, are they necessarily proportionate, subject to legal certainty? You know, you need some some framework like that for assessing law, proposed law in these areas, so that we can just start to be a little bit more fine-grained and nuanced about ideas which look like good ideas, ideas which look like bad ideas. Because I think essentially there isn't an option of 5 years of really careful, holistic thinking. No, I'm sure it's not what you're proposing.
I'm not naive. I mean, I'm absolutely no. I mean, this is one of the reasons why I'm suggesting that actually we think about what the vision is right now. So I mean, to come to Robin's point, in a way, where are we going to be in 5 to 10 years? So I think if we don't, if we do simply do additional changes and edits to specific rules without any vision as to where we want to end up, then I think these companies and these organizations will become more dominant. They will take over more parts of our lives, and we'll become more reliant on them. So in other words, what I'm suggesting is not that we stop anything, but that
right.
we actually say, okay, where do we want to be in 5 or 10 years' time? And if we want to be in a decentralized world, if we want to be in a world where we don't rely incredibly heavily on half a dozen probably US-based companies, if we want to be in a world where we can use data, personal data, for health reasons, for good reasons, but it doesn't get abused for political reasons and for elections, then we kind of need to have a roadmap. We have to have a vision as to where it was we want to get to, and then start to work towards it. Otherwise, all we're doing, endlessly, is tinkering with existing laws. We're trying to deal with specific problems as they arise. And my point is that actually that will have lots and lots of knock-on effects, and actually could make things do more harm to it.
Because he jumped again.
I
want to jump back. But you can jump in turn. Bart has already touched on this question of what happens if we do nothing. And I want to give my colleagues here a chance to come back on that question, the other questions. But I just want to, I can't resist abusing the chair. Sorry, Angela, you waited to come in.
I will
just do my little recap. And I'll ask you. I mean, I think a lot of these questions, one of the things that I'm kind of running through in my mind, because I know none of you have read the book, right? We have this wonderful advantage that we've read the book, and yes, it does solve all these problems. But we have put together a number of loosely related problems under this rubric of digital dominance. And it's partly because some of these issues, when we look back through a media lens, present themselves in terms of a question around whether a mixed media system, where you have competition in some parts of the market and regulation in all parts of the market, but less competition and public provision, can kind of solve these problems. And through a media lens, a lot of these questions of media pluralism, balances around freedom of expression, misinformation, information, a balance seems to have shifted in the sense that competition can't be relied on to deal with those balances between consumer interest and citizen interest that Sonia was speaking about. The balance seems to have been upset in a way. So, at the same time, one of the other things we're trying to put on the table here is that there are new problems, new questions, which have nothing to do with media pluralism, public information, or journalism. They are more broadly to do with the consequences, the competitive consequences of these kind of platforms. So we've pushed together a number of questions, and I think that one of the things that Martin is trying to say is that we actually need some quite new concepts for thinking about these questions. There's a lot of theorizing about the notion of power in the back end of the book, and thinking about what dominance and power means in a world of artificial intelligence, automation, and ubiquitous data-driven technologies. You know, these are the horizon issues that we're grappling with. But the linking question through all of them is, will competition sort this out? To what extent does the existing paradigm of competition regulation offer a solution to sort this out? And what aspects of this problem have to do with market dominance? So that was just to kind of clarify how I see the linking issues, because it's not clear to those people who maybe haven't read. Sorry,
Just about remember what I was going to say. There are several things that come up. One is that I absolutely agree that to think of this simply now in terms of the dominance of the press is slightly absurd. It's so much bigger than that now. And the issue of press and press competition is just quite a small part of what we're looking at. I also think that, exactly as Sonia was saying earlier, that we can't really think in terms of these little, small changes that are fiddling at the edges of a much, much bigger problem. And Martin raised one thing, which I've also been looking at, being completely absorbed in over the last few months, because I too have just published a book on this particular area, and that's the question of advertising platforms. And one of the things that I think is really important is this is a systemic issue, and you have to look at the systems. I mean, what's happened to the press, what's happened to the media, is a problem that arises because of the way the system works. So you need to look much deeper than just a question of even a big question such as press competition. And one of the reasons we're in the situation we're in at the moment is because search in particular, but also Facebook and social networking, have been driven by a particular kind of advertising, organized around a particular kind of data collection. And that has completely upset the way in which, or changed the way in which we think about how business is done, but also it's changed the way people communicate with each other. Because most of fake news came about because if you can get lots and lots of people to click on your headline, you get money. And what Martin raises the issue of the incentives. Trying to unpick the role that advertising has played on the internet is quite complicated, but it has been a very important and absolutely pernicious role. I think that some of the changes that are happening right now in data protection are going to have an impact. We haven't mentioned the GDPR at the moment, the General Data Protection Regulation, which has just come onto the books, which is European legislation, which is going to change the way in which data is collected and fundamentally change the relationship between publishers, advertisers, and the middle people in between, who are the data collectors. This change in relationship is going to have very big effects, which we haven't yet. I hope you're all here going to be examining them, because you're probably a better place to do it than I am, but it definitely needs to be done. So something is changing already, and that shows us that regulation at a much more fundamental level can have an impact. And one of the things that I feel that we need to be thinking about, again, is not simply trying to talk about media literacy, and it's not talking about hate speech specifically, but going back to thinking about how we've dealt with monopoly in media in the past, with the telegraph, the coming of radio, and the coming of television. And we have, in Europe, the telegraph was nationalized, and radio and television were made to be publicly owned goods. We need to be thinking much more radically about the fact that search is a public interest matter. Search is a utility. Search does not have to be owned by a private company. We need to be thinking about whether there are other modes, which I'm sure Martin probably doesn't agree with this, but we need to be thinking about other modes of ownership. Because search is just search. It doesn't have to be the way it is. There are other ways of organizing it. We need to be thinking beyond the problem as it has been presented to us. There are perhaps bigger solutions.
I'm going to ask you just to hold on to these questions, because we have a number of people who've been indicating they want to ask a question, including the author of Jeremy Corbyn's Digital Manifesto.
Democracy
Digital Democracy Manifesto.
I'd like to back up Andrew on this. I mean, I think this is really important issue, is that tinkering around with regulation is not really going to get us anywhere. But we should remember that, you know, the biggest purveyors of fake news in this country are not just the Tory newspapers, but the BBC. I mean, as we've seen in the last few years, the Labour left has been demonised by this. And one of the things that happened during the election campaign is actually, you know, we talk about digital governance, it actually broke the analogue governance, the society of the spectacle, where people were just passive consumers of the media. Yeah? And in the last election, the two top shared websites were actually web pages were actually from Another Angry Voice, which is a lone blogger in Europe. The rest of them were, or lots of these, what are now called New Left websites, you know, the Canary, School Bots, Vox Politics involved, and it actually allowed us to break that knot where we were demonised as the liberal left. I mean, I lived through the 1980s, Adam Knight labels his love, he said, it's Facebook what won it, because it actually, Facebook is what the 20, 30, 40, 50 somethings use. Actually, the youth don't use it, actually, my students don't use it, because their parents are. Yeah. You're not going to put up your party photos on Facebook for them to look at. Yeah. So we have to realise that actually these platforms have been an advance over the analog media, including public service broadcasting, because it is the lying machine of the British establishment and has been since the 1920s. So what we need to do, I think, is to actually not think about public service ownership, but to think about democratisation. You said that the state is not involved. They're the state. It's the National Security Agency that helps fund governments. So they are there, in there, but they're being used for a very particular thing, which is mass surveillance. What we need to think about is how can we rejig these things to actually produce things like cooperative governance. Now, there is a side of the internet, open source software, the rest of it, which we can use as a model, platform cooperative. As well. And I think that's the way forward, democratisation of the internet, not corporatisation, whether it's by the state or by private interest.
Okay, so to kind of agree with Angela's point on regulation and search, I'm Megan from Channel 4, by the way. I just wanted to ask how the panel thought that we could preserve our public service broadcasting institutions in the face of this digital dominance, and if I could just draw on an example. In the future, increasingly using voice assistants such as Siri or Alexa, and I ask for news headlines just kind of to my television, what news is getting promoted to me? Is it the BBC? Is it Channel 4? Or is it just misinformation? And actually, I think it's whoever that owns that platform that can push out whatever news that kind of shape them in a higher speed. So I just wanted to know what the panel thought about regulation.
We have a round of comments from anybody who would like to comment at this point. Martin?
I just think this is great. This is sort of what I meant in a way, in the sense that I think exactly as James spent more effort than I did, and Angela, but that we need bigger thinking. We need more conceptual thinking. We need to rethink an awful lot of the ideas that we've had in the past, because they don't work. They don't work in the environment. The transition we're going through, I think, is. And Robert McChesney talks of these critical junctures, and this being a particular critical juncture, along with printing and writing, etc. This is a really significant change we're going through. And I think we have to apply enough thinking to enable us to navigate this change, and navigate in such a way that we end up in the world where we want to be, and not the world where we kind of get shuffled into, either by the equivalent of the Chinese state or equivalent of Googles and Facebooks. And just to come back on one specific thing, because I think it is valuable to look at international comparisons in this case. Actually, I think it is different than the press, particularly, because these are transnational organisations, and B, because as far as I can tell, in this particular case, when David and I gave evidence to the Home Affairs Select Committee, how long did they take pressuring us to say, so should we have the NetzDG German law here? So do you think it's a good idea to have it here? So what version of it would you have here? And the number of different permutations of questions that they asked, it was pretty clear where they were going. And we do have also our own sort of recommendations from the U.S. here, like the intimidation of public life, from the Committee of Standards of Public Life, which I think is a very difficult and problematic recommendation. So I think there are a lot of transnational comparisons which policymakers are using, which I think we have to look to. The very reason these are transnational problems.
Sonia,
yes. So new thinking sounds great. I'd also like to put in a plug for evidence, and I want to point to two kinds. So firstly, young people do use Facebook. Facebook and Google are the top apps, and crucially, what do they use Facebook for? Not to post their private life to their nearest and dearest, but they use Facebook, they use Instagram, they use WhatsApp, they use Messenger.
Owned by Facebook.
They log in with the Facebook plugin to everyone, which Zuckerberg may not know where that data goes, but I hope it's in the book, we do. And so actually young people are not opting out of this and are absolutely, in fact, all of us. So I'm with Angela and her concern, and I've become a GDPR watcher, like a number of people have probably for the last few months, and I too think that the problem is much bigger than journalism and the status of news. And so I'm becoming very worried by the idea that people are at a Google school, kids go to a Google school, that there's a deal between Google and hospitals to share medical data for machine learning and AI and so forth. And I think so many of our public, long-term public bodies and organisations are now doing private partnerships. So those privacy concerns, I think, are completely terrifying. And I want to use that thought to go back to Robin's question, which I've been wondering about. Okay, so suppose in the next 5 to 10 years we do nothing. So one option is, I interview a lot of ordinary people in my daily life. I've never known people, and I have done 40 years, I've never known people so worried about the media and information environment as they are now. It's a kind of on the doorstep, I've come in, I need to talk to you about where my data, what's happening, who's owning, what's behind that. People are really, so one kind of conversation one hears is, glibly named the digital detox. There is a sense in which people are backing away and moving away from it, and that may happen more. There is clearly a sense of enormous kind of distrust of all kinds of organisations, and that distrust, I think, is now going to spread to all the public bodies who are now sharing their data with or don't even know who they're sharing their data with in the society. But the fear, and that might provoke a range of reactions. I think the call on government to act is actually enormous and cannot be ignored for the next 10 years. I also think that there's the beginning of a new market for privacy-respecting, trustworthy products of various kinds, from privacy-respecting search to whatever else, and that will spread. And who will take that up? The educated middle classes. And then we'll have the educated middle classes with the kind of nous to protect themselves and place some kinds of limits and make some kinds of judgments. And a host of intermediaries will spring up because there will be a market for them. And as it were, the majority of the population will be left unaddressed. And at that point, I think we should stop talking about media and regulation altogether and start thinking about problems of populism, or what somebody called the T and B word.
Luca Schiavoni, alumnus here and analyst of the telecoms industry, especially from a regulatory perspective. My starting point is that the economic part of all this discussion is the key. And that's because these companies are invariably tasked with maximizing profit. Otherwise, we wouldn't even have the addiction problem that is starting to be part of the discussion. So they have to go to their advertisers and say, we've got billions of eyeballs on our screens. They have to go to their investors and say, look, everyone's advertising to us. We are profitable. So I think that's the problem. So with that in mind, I have a couple of questions. One of them is, to make the market a bit more competitive, could we think of something like an obligation to share the these companies' data assets, much in the same way as we did for the telecommunications industry, access regulations implemented, and now we can choose between four or five different operators for our home broadband. And the second question that I have is, pretty much every other day when we talk about these problems, someone wakes up in the morning and says, we need to break up Facebook. Now, personally, I have no idea what it would look like in practice, but I'm wondering if this is discussed in the book, it has been tackled in... I'm not convinced of any answer anyone's provided yet. And finally, I think about GDPR, because I do believe that it's a very important step forward, but I think it will only succeed if it will change citizens, users' behavior, if they start thinking as privacy as a central problem, and if it becomes a problem that is an incentive to stop services people do not trust. Because the comfort zone currently created by technology is stronger. People don't leave these services when some data breach occurs. They continue, they go ahead. So we still need to see evidence of whether GDPR will work.
I do think the issue about GDPR is a different issue completely. GDPR is going to have an impact on the way in which advertising is sold. It's the trust between the companies that is the critical issue here. It actually isn't to do with the individuals. It's to do with whether or not the companies can trust the company further downstream to have actually complied with the legislation.
You're going to continue that over drinks.
I'll continue a little bit. I'm Sally Bratt from UEA's Centre for Competition Policy and also LSE in London. You keep coming back to the question of can competition policy sort any of this out? And I think there are things that competition policy can be doing, and one of them is addressing the issue that it isn't just that the trust among companies along this value chain, it's that some companies have all the pieces of that value chain. They are invested in the ad tech, in the platforms that serve the advertisers, the platforms that serve the buyers, all of that very complicated ecosystem that is online advertising. There are companies that have all of those pieces. And that is some place where competition policy, at least in Europe, I think, perhaps not in the US, but in Europe, European competition policy could play a role. And the other thing, I think, gets back to the GDPR, and I think there is a role for the GDPR part that is related to citizens, and that is where competition policy can help enforce portability as a switching, because competition requires switching, right? And if people can't switch, then that won't fail. So if the portability aspect of GDPR can really be enforced and pushed, then that will give potential for new entrants, for competition, etc. There are massive limits, though, and where I'm going to say a lot of the stuff that we're talking about, competition policy can't solve, but fundamental human rights are there. And that is where I think we need to be also pushing action in relation to platform.
Thank you. We're into the last round of questions. We might run a few minutes over because there's still some energy in the room. And one of our authors, and there are two people here, and anybody else now or never?
Nathan from the Voice Institute of Journalism. I think there's been a lot of discussion about sort of the harm, the potential harm, and I don't think we necessarily, and particularly when we're thinking about legislation or regulation, we need to be concerned about the unintended consequences. And in one of the points we make in the chapter is a lot of the positive sides of social media, in particular in terms of diversity, the way it reaches people that traditional media are really struggling to reach on the internet. So different kinds of demographics with news in much the way that television used to, for example. So I think there's a lot of positives here, a lot of negatives that we need to consider. And the other thought and question is whether actually just the power balance is shifting, and actually it's not really about regulators, it's about audience members themselves and consumers who will be able to hold these big companies to account, because if it's something Facebook and Google are concerned about, it's the wrath of ordinary people if they've used their data or whatever. And I think we've seen that on a number of occasions where audiences, you know, these companies really fear the power that audience is now at. So maybe the accountability comes in the future in different ways.
Okay. Brief, pithy sum ups in a minute, but last two brief questions before we go for drinks.
I'm Simon Khan. On the basis of what I've heard this evening, I'm not convinced that dominance is the issue in the way that some of the speakers have been seeking to suggest. And I'll give two examples. First one, there's a world of difference between a recognized news outlet getting its facts wrong because it hasn't done its research properly, and on the other hand, an unidentified or unknown non-news outlet deliberately inventing information for the sake of attracting clicks and the various things that go with it. And originally, fake news was the phrase used to describe the latter, whereas the former is a different problem solved through regulation. The former is something that can take a long time to resolve, because the information that the news outlet may have been using may be wrong. Whereas if you've invented something as clickbait, I don't think 48 hours is an unreasonable length of time to identify that there was no evidence whatsoever. So I think you need to separate those two things out. And I don't think that's got anything to do with dominance. On the other hand, and my second example, one of the speakers, I think it was you, Martin, referred to Amazon using the clouds, the information, oh, sorry, it was Patrick, using cloud servers, the information from that, to influence and to provide good information about what companies are doing that might compete with them. Now, that is a classic issue of competition policy. It's to do with that, whether or not there are suitable firewalls between the different businesses. And if you put those firewalls in place, and that causes Amazon to decide that actually it no longer wants to be in the server market because it's not getting the benefit from it, then you knew it was an abuse of a dominant position and problem is solved. And if it causes them to stay in the market but with firewalls, then fine. If that's what they want to do, they're okay with it. So I think competition law does work where there is genuine dominance, but the intractable problems, I'm not persuaded on the basis of this evening, they're actually driven by dominance. I think they're driven by other features.
Thank you. Mark Lensing. I was at Ofcom in its early years when we were grappling with the complex citizen issues and problems that Sonia and Martin were talking about at the beginning. And I think what we can take from that experience is there's no playbook for addressing these sorts of issues characterized by difficulty of definition, balances of rights, abstraction. You kind of learn by doing on those sorts of things, and you have to develop bespoke solutions for different issues, and you have to iterate those solutions, and you have to be in a position to assess the impact of what you're doing. Now, it seems to me that a big part of the problem we've got is that far from the internet being a wild west, actually we have got organisations that are grappling with those issues, that are, you know, learning the context, trying to find solutions to difficult problems. And then the platforms themselves, who are undertaking very extensive efforts to try to act on some of the alleged online harms without anything very much by way of oversight and accountability. And it seems to me that that is an urgent problem. You know, as Will mentioned, the government intends to regulate. I think the starting point has got to be trying to get ourselves in a position where we have the forums and institutions that enable us to understand what it is the platforms are actually doing on things like hate speech, extremist content, protection of children, all of which, you know, have kind of huge teams of engineers working on automated tools to address them. And before we have that context in place, it's very hard to work out what kind of regulation might be needed on top of it, but we certainly need the mechanisms of evaluating it.
Thank you. Final thoughts in this order?
Well, this is actually all.
Dan Johnston, I'm a master's student, and I also do some work for Dow Jones as well. My question is about big data, machine learning, and algorithmic systems, and basically how they're kind of driving policy for a lot of these organisations.
to the point where they're so complex that these organisations can't even regulate themselves. So is it in some quarters you've got people calling for regulation of algorithms, transparency, all in this of them. Is it desirable? Is it possible?
Can you weave that in?
that's a tricky one. The truth is that the nature of machine learning is that no one understands what the algorithm is doing once it's learned from a lot of data. Having said that, it's not sort of out of control. It is actually possible then to set criteria and push back, even if you don't actually understand the way the algorithm's working. It's a somewhat technical question. On this question of, you know, can we use competition policy? I mean, the truth is, all of this is very recent. I think, as Martin said, just 2 years ago or whatever, the dialogue was extremely different. We don't yet have sufficient conceptual tools for sort of discussing these things. We do have competition policies. These are very big American companies. In principle, you might say, share your data. In principle, you might say, these Silicon Valley companies have to put firewalls in and glass walls in and so on. Even if we still had the 44th president of the United States, good luck with that. I just don't see it happening. There's a big, we haven't talked about this, there's a geopolitical dimension to this. Even before we introduced the Chinese, there's a geopolitical dimension to this in which, so here we are in Europe and the UK, actually not in a position of power to get these companies. We can get them to do certain things here. Okay, we might be able to get them to start paying taxes if we work at the Europe level. It'd be difficult, but getting them to share their data, getting them to put proper internal walls in so that Amazon doesn't quote the data from AWS. About its clients. Good luck with that.
So one of the things we haven't really discussed is the possibility or the hope of international solutions to what is evidently an international problem. So I think the fear among many of our politicians is that if we try to regulate Amazon to get out of the cloud market, they'll just get out of the UK market, and then we'll. So we're trying to stop that happening. We don't have the mechanisms for real international collaboration as we have just seen from Canada this week. I'm all for more forums. Maybe this is one. There should be many more. And Nick, my last point maybe. So can audiences hold people to account? I feel that's a bit like the media literacy thing. So when all else has failed, let's hope that the citizen can kind of step up. And at that point, I think we need an analysis of the structure, the legal aid provision, the access to legal support that it would take for any ordinary person. We used to have, of course, a wonderful champion of the audience in the figure of Paul Davis, so now we need a new person championing audience power.
Just finish up briefly on really this question of dominance, because we are coming back to the question of dominance. Briefly, yes, Mark, if you ask your question, more forums would be great. I think we have to look at the issue of dominance for lots of reasons. I mean, and that's, again, coming back to the structure of the book, economic, political, social, that was deliberate. I mean, I think last week you saw this, the article in The Economist talking about how they have a phrase, was it that small companies are in the kill zone if they are doing something which overlaps or might overlap in any way with what the tech giants are doing, because they know that if the tech giants turn around and decide to do it themselves, they're dead in the water, or they get bought up, which is the objective they have in the first place. But just to pick a couple of specific instances to address your question of dominance. So, I recommend Damien's chapter. I mean, if you look at elections, the issue around the idea of a one-stop shop, I mean, the importance that Facebook has taken on in election campaigns in a very, very short time, it's remarkable. And if, what we find, we think coming back at IQ, if as a campaign
you go to a third party and you funnel all your money through a third party, which so much goes to Facebook, so much goes elsewhere. It's essentially a black box, and we have mostly financial regulation of elections, and it's incredibly hard to scrutinise when it all goes into a single bucket. Take the problem, the systemic problem that Andrew talked about, which I think is absolutely right. But you take the systemic problem in advertising. You know, when you're talking about two companies, taking what is it, 60% of the digital ad spend, they create the system, they create the standards, they set the terms for all the smaller players. So you can't, I don't think, really deal with the systemic aspects of advertising if you don't deal with the dominance of these two particular companies. And just the final one, which is around news itself, to give. I don't think it's as easy to distinguish between anymore, the kind of big and the small when it comes to news providers. I think there's a huge spectrum of different producers out there. And the reason why dominance, I think, is particularly important is if you look at the example of what Facebook did with instant articles. Facebook introduced this system whereby you can upload your articles, whether you're the BBC or whether you're Canary or whether you're anyone, straight to their site in the spring of 2015. Well, they started off with very big companies. 6 months later, they said, OK, we'll open it out to smaller companies. And 6 months after that, they said, we'll open it out to native advertising. You know, and then people were surprised that people's news feeds on Facebook were filled with news, non-news, and they couldn't distinguish any of it because Facebook hadn't distinguished any of it. So I think, you know, in lots of the different areas that we discussed, you can't separate the dominance of these players with some of the problems that come with what they've done.
Thank you all very much, and thank you all very much here in the audience for you know, Robin, I think we are condemned to act. I don't think doing nothing is an option in the sense that I wonder who the we is, if we don't get involved in some of these debates and discussions, these problems will be resolved by the platforms, and the challenge is to find a language and find concepts to actually discuss these kinds of difficult, complexes of issues. I still think we're at something of a crossroads, in the sense that the classic question is always break up companies that are too big, or regulate monopolies, or some kind of intervention to try and think through new theories of harm to deal with the competition framework as it applies. So I think it's been very useful. I always come back to a slightly spooky scenario, which I'm going to leave you with before we troop off and have a drink and forget about these terribly bleak things. But if a party stood here or elsewhere on a manifesto of breaking up Google and Facebook, what would happen to their online propaganda? And how do we know what would happen to their online propaganda? Would it be safe in the hands of those that are distributing it? I don't know the answer to that question, but I think we should all keep it in mind as we think about these things. Housekeeping, first of all, we have a small number of copies of the book available. You all have order forms. They are for discounted copies. We have a small number of people who are desperate to get their hands on the copies. That's available in the cryptocurrency that we know as cash. 20 quid, it's yours. It's cheaper if you order it yourself. I'd like to thank very much the Department of Media Communications and the T3 Commission, and particularly Julia Zima, who has pulled this event together so ably and well. Thank you. I'd like to thank my co-editor, Martin. It's been a real pleasure and a privilege to work with you. Thank you very much.